Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. My name is Mason, and before we talk about today's episode, I wanted to let you know, I just got back from an amazing trip on a river, and I know we've had a lot of river and water-based content and episodes lately, and I think that's just, you know, the time of year. Sometimes it's just coincidental. We kind of go through ebbs and flows on the show. Sometimes we get a lot of mountaineers or backpackers or, gosh, whatever, you know, flight-based adventures, but right now there's just a lot of water. One, I'm super interested in. I've been doing a river-based trip pretty much every 8 weeks for the last year. Sometimes we do biking and river base, but a little bit about this weekend. My friends and I, if you don't know, about a year and a half ago, committed to doing a trip together every 8 weeks, no matter what, every 8 weeks, not exactly 8 weeks. Sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's, you know, six or seven, but we try to average it out to every 8 weeks. We have an adventure to look forward to. And these adventures are close to home, around 24 hours. We tried to max it at 24 hours for a while, but honestly, they're creeping up to more like 48-hour trips, two nights camping, because what happens is we'll leave on a Friday night to go camp somewhere, wake up Saturday, do the adventure, camp Saturday, maybe finish the adventure or head home early on Sunday. They have been actually creeping a little longer than that lately, to where it's like I'm gone Friday night to Sunday night pretty late, but trying to dial it back so that my family isn't without me super long. But doing it every 8 weeks is awesome because you can fit so much adventure into a weekend, quite a lot. Like you can basically cover every major pillar of adventure, from wilderness to you know, camping out there, to just like ticking all those boxes of fulfillment in just a weekend. And it's been so much fun because no matter how busy life gets, I am able to find one weekend out of eight that I can make something happen with my friends. And it has grown. So this past weekend, we did the Ocklawaha River in Central Florida, and we saw, and some springs that were along the way, like 10 miles of springs. So just imagine crystal clear water, a bluish water actually, similar to the Caribbean, in a river, beautifully peaceful, with gators and snakes and manatees and fish and beautiful seagrass on the bottom. Unbelievable. And it's for miles and miles. And there were actually monkeys out there, wild monkeys. It's these kind of common term is squirrel monkeys, and they've been out there nearly 100 years. They're not a native. They're definitely invasive, but it's just an amazing experience to see them out there. And it was so cool. We had almost 20 people go on this one, and it has grown from me and two friends to nearly 20 people every trip. So if you would like to go, if you find yourself in Central Florida in the next 2 months, probably around mid-July, let me know. We'd love to have you. We've got plenty of extra equipment, camping gear. It is a ton of fun. We take care of the food, so we just like pool all our money together to buy a bunch of food, and it's around like literally like $8 a person, so not a lot. That's the only cost associated with the trip, other than your gas to get there. So it's been awesome. It's been absolutely incredible. We've been doing this over a year and a half, and it was originally inspired by the episode Fraser Bunton that we had on, who commits with his friends every year to do one major trip. They just call it the big trip once a year, and they have all these really cool rules about how they make it happen with 15 to 20 very busy people to travel internationally or to travel across the country and make an adventure happen every year with the same friend group. So it's been awesome. So Fraser was the inspiration there. We were doing it a little bit before Fraser's episode came out about a year and a half ago, but that definitely solidified the plan. So check that out. Just, you know, look that up on our website, Fraser Bunton, F-R-A-Z-E-R, B-U-N-T-I-N, I believe. But anyway, so yeah, that was my weekend. And I'm excited to listen to this story again with Thomas Elpel, because he literally carved out a 20-foot Douglas fir with the great-great-great-great-grandson of Captain William Clark of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, and followed a 5-month expedition following the same exact route along the Missouri River that Lewis and Clark took all the way to Gateway Arch in St. Louis. So started in Montana, went to Missouri. unbelievable story. And Thomas is such an interesting, fascinating individual. He has a YouTube channel that shows him building his house by hand with the stones on his property, all reclaimed wood and windows, and just really always doing really interesting projects like that, living out in Pony, Montana, way out in the middle of nowhere. And I just love that stuff. And I love his lifestyle and what he's doing. So you're going to really enjoy the story, but I wanted to make sure all of y'all knew about the adventures I'm doing, and know that you're welcome to come. Just reach out and let me know if you're in the area. All right, let's go ahead and jump in. Perfect. Well, you know, I know you just got off the Missouri River, but I actually don't know, like, what day did you actually finish the trip?
November 3rd, we arrived in St. Louis at the Arch. So that was the end. Yeah. And then it took a little bit of time to get back to Montana.
Oh, my gosh. Now, could you see the Arch from quite a ways away?
A couple miles out, not a huge distance.
So not like 3 days out, you could see the Arch.
No, the Arch is, you know, we talk about paddling the length of the Missouri, and the Arch is actually on the Mississippi. So it's a sort of a symbolic ending point. There isn't really a good place to take, you know, if you just do the whole Missouri, there isn't any place to take out of the water there anyway. So so the option is either you take out about 3 miles shy of the end of the Missouri, or you finish the Missouri and you go around on the Mississippi a little bit, and paddle to the Arch is just a nice symbolic ending.
Oh, absolutely. People know where it is. You know, it's nice, you know, like you said, ending point, and it assures that you did the whole Missouri, you know?
Yes, it does.
But you don't have anybody questioning, well, you actually stopped where, you know, a mile before it actually is considered the Mississippi. And so you get to disregard all the naysayers. But if you don't mind, I'd love to go back. Where are you coming from today for the interview?
So I live in Pony, Montana, southwestern Montana, about a half an hour from the Missouri headwaters, where the Jefferson, Madison, and Gallatin rivers come together to form the Missouri River.
So Pony, Montana, first of all, that's the name of the town, Pony?
Wow. Pony is the name of the town, yeah.
Must be pretty small.
It's pretty small and pretty sweet, just nestled in the foothills of the Tobacco Root Mountains. About 120 people here, and that's just right for me.
Wow, man. Have you ever, I mean, did you grow up there?
No, I went to a school over in Bozeman, on the other end of the valley. So that's a little bigger. That's a real town.
Bozeman, man. Holy cow, man. 120 people. I went through one town one time in Montana called Judith Gap. I think it was 25. And I think I met everybody in town that day.
I walked through, did a walk across Montana 31 years ago that went through Judith Gap, and we stopped and had pie at the restaurant there. So
that is hilarious. A walk across Montana. That sounds like an episode in itself.
Oh, that was a long time ago.
So you're kind of, you've been an adventurer for your whole life, it sounds like.
Well, yes and no. I did raise four kids in between that expedition and this one. So that had a lot to do with the current one. Is I'm a recent empty nester and thought, hey, I can, you know, I've been saving up for a while to, you know, to go do something. And so, yeah, I wasn't sure. I was debating between bicycling across the U.S. or walking the Appalachian Trail or paddling the Missouri, and the Missouri won out. So that was it for the year.
Oh, man, I've got so many interesting, I got so many tangents I want to go on. Those are three great options. First of all, I'm definitely partial to the bike traveling, but as far as the most unique of the three, you definitely chose the right one.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really understand that beforehand. You know, take like the Appalachian Trail, there's thousands of people that start that every year and a couple Absolutely. Hundred that finish. And in comparison, the Missouri River is similar in length to the Appalachian Trail. But if you look at the on MissouriRiverPaddlers.com, they have a database of all the past expeditions. And if you look at the list through 1962 there, it's been like less than 50 people. And that just seems crazy to me. It has its challenging aspects, but in comparison to, say, putting on a backpack and walking the length of the Appalachian Trail, this is seems easier in the sense that, you know, we've got canoes to carry our gear. We basically spend most of the summer like turtles laying on a log, you know, drifting down the river.
you can carry however much booze, however much equipment, whatever you want, you can pretty much carry, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it was a good trip for sure.
Man. Well, you know what you, I don't know. You're right. The AT would be harder, but there's also like a billion guides on how to do it and, you know, resources galore. And you wouldn't probably hardly have much of a experience of solitude or wilderness compared to something like this. So, you know, the fact that only 50 people-ish have done this, that is, there must have not been that many resources to go off of to plan.
Yes and no. There are some good resources out there. David Miller's book, The Complete Paddler, was very helpful. And I actually spent some, I mean, originally I was just thinking about winging it as far as, you know, you put the canoe in the water and you start paddling. But, the fact that I was paddling a very heavy, hand-carved, dugout canoe, meant that I had to coordinate some of our portages around the dams. And so I had to be able to predict when we were going to be there. And so I started laying out like a theoretical schedule to get at least through the first few dams. And then I ended up doing that all the way down to St. Louis. So working between the Complete Paddler book and Google Earth, putting together, projected campsites for each day. And we didn't have to follow that, but it actually turned out being really helpful having that as a reference point.
So there is a guidebook out there for it. That's just one though. No, I'm just playing. I'm sure there's, that's incredible. I mean, you know, there's so many things you mentioned before. You raised four kids, first of all. Holy cow. I'm on my first and it's given me a time, but first of all, you're an empty nester. What did your kids think about this? They must've thought dad's crazy.
Oh, they knew I was crazy. So, and I don't think it surprised them too much.
That is too cool, man. So, and I didn't even mention one of the most amazing parts of all this. You did this in a canoe that you dug out of essentially a log.
Yeah. So I worked with Churchill Clark last year on that project. So he's the great, 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 great grandson of Captain William Clark of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And so we spent about 3 months carving a canoe out of a big Douglas fir log. And we tested it last year, did a week-long trip on the Marias River here in Montana. And then basically when we finished that trip, I started planning for this year's trip.
Did you have any experience with digging out canoes out of wood?
I didn't, but he did. So he was the one who knew what he was doing. And I just did grunt work to remove bulk material. So the engineering, the design of it... was all his part of that, and also the artistic side of it. I don't know if you looked at any of the pictures online, but
I did.
Yeah, I got the he carved the beaver face into the front. It's got a tail on the back, and just really turned into a gorgeous work of art. You know, I was just thinking, well, a dugout canoe, and I hadn't thought in artistic terms of it. But what the touch he added was just amazing.
And now, you know, being the, like you said, the great, great, great grandson of William Clark, is this just something he's done to kind of continue that tradition of expedition or of ruggedness? And yeah, you're right. It's beautiful. And I think her name was Bella. I kind of mixed up questions there, but is that something he's been doing for a while?
So the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial was 2004 through 2006. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't had experience before that, but he figured, you know, hey, it was in the family. So he went out and joined the reenactors that were retracing the route. And so part of that, he ended up, you know, on a dugout canoe, going upriver, up the Missouri, and then rode horses over the mountains and paddled down the other side to the Pacific, and then came all the way back the following year there. And and along the way, they or over one of the winter breaks there, they he got experience working on a dugout canoe. And so now that's what he does, is he travels the country making dugout canoes. So he's made several. And I was lucky to get him up to our skills camp. I have a kids program and an adult program. The kids program is Outdoor Wilderness Living School, or OWLS. And so I work with the public schools here to get the kids out of the classroom to do wilderness survival skills. Things like starting fires by rubbing sticks together, foraging for wild plants, building shelters, a stocking game, so things like that. And so the canoe project, it was more of one that they could learn about. It wasn't so much a hands-on type project. But
kind of learn along with you.
Yeah, they could definitely, they were interested. They were very interested in that. And then my adult program, Green University, you know, have students that come in and out of that. So we had some people get in on it that way as well.
Wow. So you're sitting here now, this is a skill you didn't have. So you're learning this skill, but it's probably safe to say for the other skills needed on the trip, you were pretty ready. What was it? What was the process, the journey like making the canoe itself? It sounded like it was almost as long as the paddle itself.
Yes. I mean, yes and no. We took off, we did the majority of the work in the first 2 weeks. But, you know, the closer you get to the end, the longer it takes. And so, you know, it just went slower and slower as we were fine tuning it. And of course, we're running kids camps in the middle of all that. So it's not like the canoe was the only thing that was happening.
Right. Of course. Yeah. Life still happens around adventures is what we learn on this show. You got to fit it in where you can. We've talked to plenty of people who are like, I had 20, 30 years of raising kids and now I'm doing adventures. And it's like, all right, that's awesome. and so you're right on track for that. Was there ever a time where you just thought, man, forget this, let me just go buy a canoe?
Oh, not at all. No. And same for being on the river, you know, the guys that were with me had modern canoes and I just had no desire to trade places with anybody. That's not to say it was always easier in the dugout canoe, because it definitely was not as streamlined or, you know, and the lakes in particular, it was like paddling a log.
Yeah,
so,
literally.
but there's something just a little more solid and real about it. It's hard to describe, but, you know, when you paddle a dugout canoe, it's the real deal. And you know, so I just didn't want to leave that.
No, I what an amazing aspect to add to it that a lot of people wouldn't even think about, you know, and just a way to, you've had a lot of time to think about the journey before you actually went on the journey.
Yeah. And the fact that dugout canoe project came together is what had cemented the decision, you know, whereas instead of doing a hiking trip or a biking trip, the fact that kind of serendipitously came together is what decided it, that I would do the canoe trip. And another guy here had actually donated an old, you know, worn out dugout canoe for a museum piece to my kids camp there. And then he sold me his dugout canoe trailer that was custom built. And it's like, there's not a lot of dugout canoe trailers in the world, but this one just kind of landed in my lap. And so there's this kind of serendipitous element that all these things came together that, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, this canoe trip is going to happen.
It's meant to be.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I tell you, you have an incredible, like, two-part two videos on your website that kind of show the process of making it and then show part of the journey. And I'm going to totally link those, because I really encourage people to take, what is it? Let's see, 30 minutes and 20 minutes. So yeah, less than an hour of your time to watch this. It's incredible. It's exciting. You just see the hard work that goes into it. And yeah, this is a tree that you're working on, man. It is enormous. Can you just tell people, like, what was the length of your canoe overall and what was the weight and everything? Because I think it's amazing.
Yeah, so a typical tripping canoe would be about a 17-footer, and the dugout canoe is a 20-footer, so just slightly bigger, but it's quite heavy. I actually had a cottonwood picked out for it, but Churchill took a look at it and said it wasn't big enough. So then I went into panic mode looking for a big enough log, and we found this Douglas fir at a sawmill. And I got to tell you, Douglas fir is not a conventional wood for doing dugout canoes. It's hard, it's full of knots, and it cracks. And
so ideal.
Yeah. So, you know, we ended up, for one thing, we used a lot of power tools working on it, because it's like we'd chop at those knots and the tools would just bounce off.
And I saw that. And I thought, I'm like, is the blade turned around? Because it would just bounce right off. I'm like, no, they're hitting it with the blade. It is like hitting concrete.
Yeah. So and the other thing is that Douglas fir is heavy. That like cottonwood apparently loses, I think it's like half its weight when it dries out, whereas Douglas fir loses like 10% of its weight. And we've said, Churchill and I said from, you know, once we finished the canoe that it weighed like about 500 pounds, but we never actually weighed it. And you know, four of us can't even lift the head off the ground. So concluded it must be considerably more than 500 pounds. And so I'll weigh it one of these days. This hasn't happened yet, but my guess is it could be as high as like 900. So it's a heavy canoe. Definitely don't throw it over your shoulders to portage.
Yeah, logistically, that's got to just make so many things so different than a normal canoe trip because, you know, I've done canoeing. I can just pick it up myself. But this, like, what did you do to, I mean, was it hard to paddle in the water or get moving?
No, I mean, it really actually paddles quite well. Certainly not, you know, like a sleek canoe or kayak, but it paddles just fine. And it has enough mass that once you, you know, get it moving, it takes a little bit to, you know, braking to, if you're coming into shore, I got to make sure you're not coming in too hot.
Oh man, no kidding. 900 pounds, potentially 900 pounds of wood flying into shore.
Of course, you know, we can't, you know, a lot of canoes, you would take them out of the water when you get to camp. It's nice to have that option that you can just pull it up on shore. And that is, you know, did not happen with the dugout canoe. So that just, you know, it was a factor sometimes in choosing campsites, and finding a suitable place, you know, where we could, tie up or drive a stake in, knowing that we would have to, leave the canoe in the water and slog through the mud to go back and forth, to get the gear.
Wow. What a fascinating twist to put on just, you know, a canoe trip. When did you start the journey?
So we started June 1st. So it was 5 months and 3 days from Three Forks, Montana to St. Louis, Missouri. And that's about the river itself is 2,341 miles. And you miss a little bit here and there because of dams. But, you know, we did probably in the range of 2,300 miles anyway.
Holy cow. And now, can you just tell us what, once you got the canoe built, you had some logistics, your logistics figure out, you know, did you have to research the river, or were you familiar enough with the river to know, you know, you did the whole river from Three Forks, Montana to St. Louis. Like, what is the mood of this river? Is there rapids and dangers you have to watch out for like that?
As far as, you know, rapids and all that goes, it's, the Missouri is exceptionally tame. It's actually kind of shocking that a river could be so long and so flat. So there isn't much for rapids. And the main thing, though, is that of the there's 15 dams on the river with reservoirs, and so there's 700 miles of flat water. Basically, one third of the river is flat water impounded behind the dam. So that's like paddling from Seattle to San Francisco on a lake. And so that was, that's one thing Lewis and Clark didn't have to deal with. We did. And the lakes are a trial for sure.
Oh, I can imagine. I guess you lose the flow of the river at that point.
Yeah. Some of the smaller lakes are fine because there's, if they're skinny enough or they're not too windy, then we can paddle fine. But the wind is a major challenge. The first biggish lake that we encountered, Canyon Ferry Lake here in Montana, we had actually a pretty nice day on the river, and then we hit the lake and we went in right into just a headwind blew up out of nowhere. And there in that part of the reservoir, there was a bunch of what they call the duck ponds that are riprap. So it's kind of steep, rocky banks. There was nowhere where we could land safely. And so we're just basically stuck in the lake, paddling into the wind, moving forward with, inches at a time. And so hours later, we finally got past the duck ponds and, saw a sandy beach and then just went for it, hoping to, get out of the canoes and just lead them by ropes along the lakeshore. But one problem that's unique to the dugout canoe is that when you get up to the shore, if there's any waves coming in from the side, they just hit the side of the canoe and leap over into the canoe. And so basically filled it up like a bathtub in seconds. And so this was a trial in our first week there that we had to deal with. And fortunately, the wind subsided just after that. And so, bailed out the canoe and restock the gear in there and paddle into camp. But we had another incident like that on that lake where actually I had the canoe as far out of the water as could really get a heavy canoe out. And, we just camped there, but the wind came up in the night and filled the canoe like a bathtub. So, it's pretty much sitting on shore full of water.
And, oh my gosh.
So, I learned from that we just had to find a nicely protected harbor to camp at when we're on the lakes. It was never really an issue on the river, but on the lakes, had to find suitable spots that were protected to camp each night.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. Hey folks, I want to give a shout out to our newest sponsor, The Bourbon Pursuit. It's a podcast all about bourbon, the craft of bourbon. And you might be thinking, I'm a fan of bourbon. I like bourbon, but I don't love bourbon. Well, this show's probably going to change that. What I've learned is that even things I don't feel like I'm interested in, if someone can explain it to me why it's an interesting or what the craft behind it is, I find myself getting more and more interested in it. And I could absolutely see bourbon being one of those things. As you know, I work for a non-alcoholic brewery, but I still enjoy a good alcoholic drink. Not much. I'm a busy guy, so I can't drink too much, but I do enjoy a good bourbon. When we got married, my wife and I got some bourbon as a gift, and I just had never considered it till then, and I was really surprised by how much I enjoyed it. But since, it's kind of just fallen off. Life's gotten busy, but I am excited to learn more through the Bourbon Pursuit podcast. They are the official podcast of bourbon and the best source of all bourbon news, reviews, interviews with CEOs, distillers, ambassadors for the industry. They are where you go to get news and interesting information about bourbon. So join the hosts Kenny Coleman, Ryan Cecil, and Fred Minnick on an epic bourbon adventure.
You can subscribe and follow them wherever you get podcasts. And I can't thank them enough for supporting a fellow creator like me. And they're just, you know, a couple people working on a show just like me. So if you want to support them and thank them for what they're doing for Adventure Sports Podcast, go check out Bourbon Pursuit.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. My goodness, man. So many just things like that I wouldn't even think about having to deal with. But once you implement a canoe that's essentially a tank on the water, you've got all that kind of things to think about. So how did you deal with portaging it down those dams?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that trailer, the custom-built trailer. Yes. And because the canoe was so heavy, I brought the trailer, and it might sound like a logistical nightmare to bring a trailer without a truck down the river while we're paddling a canoe, but actually it was one of those serendipitous things. It just worked out quite miraculously. Of course, close to home, I had friends and family that were able to help us, but downstream just ran into people either sometimes just right at the boat ramp that could drive our trailer down to the next dam, or we connected with people online who could do it. And, you know, some cases people were going that way anyway. There's one fellow out in South Dakota who he was driving to Tennessee and volunteered to drive the trailer drop off in St. Louis on his way through. And he actually was coming back when, like 2 days after we got off the water. So he hitched the trailer up and gave us a ride partway back. And then I rented a U-Haul from there to drive back to Montana. So so basically, just hopped the trailer off from volunteer to volunteer all the way down the river and hoped it would be there when we got to the next dam. And it was.
My gosh, man, isn't that awesome that you don't have to figure out every little detail before you leave and just have faith in people that,
oh,
you know,
totally,
what?
Yes.
We're going to meet somebody. And so I assume you back the trailer in down a boat ramp, load the dugout canoe on, and then go to the other side of the dam and drop you off. That's how it works?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then they take it to the next one.
Yep.
That is crazy that you just, I mean, What a way to have faith in people, and it paid off. You know, it actually worked. That's the way it should be.
You know, that was I feel like we met some of the nicest people on the planet on this trip, and that was really one of the highlights of the journey.
Well, I'm sure everybody and their mother saw you and wanted to talk to you for, you know, as long as I'm talking to you for, like, what in the heck are you doing?
Where'd
you get that log?
We drew crowds in.
And, you know, that's so neat that the Missouri, you were able to do that for essentially the entire time. Can I tell you, how beautiful was it out there? How was the scenery, especially early on coming out of the mountains of Montana?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty incredible. There's parts that I have paddled before. The part closest to me, the Missouri headwaters down to Canyon Ferry Lake, I've done that many times because we like to go carp hunting there with bows and arrows. And I paddled the wild and scenic stretch of the river in central Montana a long time ago. But there are some very spectacular parts. The Gates of the Mountains here in Montana was amazing, and I had never done that before. And the wild and scenic part, I realized after paddling it a second time that I'm going to have to go back and do that a third time. But I think the real surprise was that the river stayed beautiful beyond there. Fort Peck Lake out in eastern Montana is really quite gorgeous. It's a bear to paddle. I mean, it's a huge lake. But it is incredible country. It's all badlands and prairie out there. But it is so beautiful, and I just love to get out and explore. And, you know, that's the thing, is I could take another month just paddling the Montana portion of the Missouri River. And, you know, Montana is a big state. There's actually one third of the entire length of the Missouri River is in Montana. Wow. So we spent two months just crossing Montana. You know, it's widely considered the most beautiful part of Missouri. But I was actually quite amazed getting into North Dakota, Lake Sakakawea in particular, was just gorgeous. I had expected in the Dakotas just to see like windswept plains and, you know, no trees at all. But no, it was some kind of badlandsy, but it was more like goodlandsy badlandsy, if that makes any sense. It was more fertile. You know,
never
Montana.
Heard anybody say goodlandsy.
Eastern Montana can be pretty desolate. And in fact, it was a month between towns out there at one point.
A month between towns.
Yeah, there's just isn't anything else out there. But yeah, out in the Dakotas, it was really beautiful, kind of like fertile badlands. And you know, all the bluffs, the little Midwestern forests and the coulees. It was quite amazing. And yeah, so really quite beautiful all the way down. And then, of course, we hit the fall colors in the last few weeks of the trip. Down south, and that was really beautiful and very different than the fall colors I'm used to here in Montana, because we don't have as many tree species, so like our fall colors are beautiful here in terms of we get this golden carpet of or you know down the rivers cottonwoods up. But down there in Missouri, it was just all these different colors, more of a painting of you know, many different hues. And so that was just a real treat.
Man, I can't imagine how awesome that was. You know, I've found that, you know, when you're adventuring through somewhere, especially not driving, but like when you're on an adventure in the middle of something, the places that may not seem as exciting geographically or just for whatever reason, they really surprise you, because you're seeing things at such a different pace than you were thinking about, or such a in a different area. And you know, I've been able to bike quite a few of the states, and some of the most memorable experiences have been in what would be considered some of the most mundane places, and those are the most cherished memories.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and I think you know, my view of the states we toured is probably a little bit skewed, because I saw it all from the water. You know, like the Dakotas, it was amazingly green and hilly and
right there at the water.
Yeah, so I don't know, I exactly saw the same Dakotas anybody else has, but I think we saw the best part.
Man, I'm telling you, that water draws the greenery, you know, so it's very well might be true.
And this year was exceptionally green. That was, I think, one of the big surprises, is I just anticipated it would be hot and dry with temperatures, you know, from 80 to 100 degrees every day. But we had like rainstorms. It seemed like about every 4 days we would get another big rainstorm. And it was spring green all the way across the Dakotas, all the way down. And then they had spring flooding this year, and we started fairly late. Since I work with kids in May, we started June 1st, which is later than most paddlers do. Mm-hmm. But so we were behind the floods most of the way. But once we got down there far enough, it was, yeah, pretty heavy flooding and kind of unprecedented to have this high of water this late in the year. And I nearly tied 2011 for the highest total runoff ever in the watershed. And that was also interesting to just from the standpoint that here in Montana, when you have a flooded river, they really rage, you know, and it's like you don't paddle flooded rivers. But the Missouri is just so big that it's more like a slow moving lake. And so even when it's flooded, it's not super hazardous.
Why don't you paddle flooded rivers?
Like the Jefferson River here, when it's up, it's moving pretty fast, and the turns, the bends are pretty tight.
Okay, I see.
And so, yeah, it's pretty hazardous. And but even the Missouri River, just at the headwaters down here, I've taken kids out there to go carp hunting during flood season, because the river is just big enough that a little bit of flooding isn't a big deal. It's just bigger and flatter, basically.
It sounds like there's just more playground at that point.
Yeah, you know, that's the funny thing on Missouri is that if you're standing on the bank, up in Montana the current moves pretty slow, but the channelized river in the last 700 miles of the Missouri River there, where it's been straightened and deepened, when you're standing on the bank, it looks like it's moving really fast, but when you're out on the water, it's almost like you're standing still. And part of that is just because it's so big that you're far away from the banks. So you don't have the feeling that you would on a small river of moving super fast. Looking at it rush by, it was really moving, and it was going at times 6 or 7 miles an hour, which is actually fairly fast.
Absolutely. And now you guys obviously didn't have an issue with having plenty of places to get water, of course, but how did you deal with food? Is it like the backpacking world where you have like maybe pre-planned meals or backpacking meals? Did you kind of put caches out there ahead of time? How did that work with like the distances in between towns?
Yeah, well, we didn't really, our group didn't really coordinate between us. Everybody kind of prepared in their own way. For me, as a writer, I focused on the important things like building a wooden desk to fit in my canoe. when it came time to get food, I just opened up the kitchen cabinet and pushed in basically anything that I wouldn't get around to eating at home. All the little random bags of rice and beans and whatnot, flour and that all went into as this plastic barrel that I carried. And the main thing is we knew we had a month long section without between towns, so we had to have a month long supply of food for that, even though most of the rest of the trip was usually just days between towns, or at most a week or two. But we brought plenty of food, and we did some foraging, really as much as we could. The first week was really one of our best for wild food foraging, in terms of we hit the wild morel mushrooms were up, so we had some great mushrooms. It was a good place for hunting carp with bows and arrows, and lots of wild greens. So we really ate royally there. And then less so in other places, just depending on what was available. But in some places, particularly Fort Peck Lake, some of the guys, Scott and John in particular, did a lot of fishing and brought in some monster northern pike and catfish and a little everything, really. And so we ate really good with that. We'd start out with fresh food whenever we left town, and then switch over to dry goods. But overall, we ate like kings out there.
Man, did you hear what you just said? You said you were bow fishing in Montana in a dugout canoe, retracing the path of Lewis and Clark. Does that get through to you just how amazing that sounds? Like, that's, it doesn't sound real.
I suppose.
I mean, as a writer, that's like the most beautiful thing, man. It's just like, what? That was your life for 5 months, essentially? Good Lord, that is amazing.
I actually have a video on YouTube of the carp hunting with bows and arrows, so it's modern canoes, not the dugout, but this is something I like to do. And that's the thing, is that the carp were originally introduced here for food, and modern Americans really disdain them as trash fish, but they're considered like a Christmas dish in some Eastern European countries, and they're really quite good. So I was hoping to hunt for carp all the way down, but it was really just this first week was the only spot that we found that was really good for hunting them.
Wow. You know, I've actually never had one just because I've heard that, but I'd love to try it. I have no qualms about giving it a shot, and definitely plentiful in places. So that might be, heck, I'd love to acquire a taste for them. That's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You might be surprised. They're really quite good.
Good. That's good to hear. You know, everyone says that, but I've never been picky, so I don't know why I listened to them in the first place. But you keep saying we, and I apologize. I haven't asked. Who is all on the trip with you?
Yeah. So there's really five of us that were on the, you know, on the official expedition, other people that came and go. And there's four of us that that finished, that did the whole thing. So that was Scott Robinson of Colorado, John Gentry of Tennessee, Chris Dawkins of Washington State, and myself. And, you know, I do canoe trips every year, typically 1 or 2 weeks, where I just say, I'm going canoeing. Who wants to come with me? And so I'm used to canoeing with you know, people that are either strangers or, you know, friends, family, former students from my Green University program, basically whoever wants to come along. And so that's what I did on this. And it's hard to find people that can drop everything, even if they want to go. It's mm-hmm. It's hard for people to walk away for what I said would be up to 6 months. To do a trip like this. So I was lucky to get the crew, you know, to get an actual crew. And I ended up with some great guys.
You know, I will say, and as we hear, you know, I hear from listeners all the time, it's not the lack of desire that keeps people from going. It's really the lack of, you know, being able to just work it out in normal life. And it usually does have to wait for a time where they're either, you know, before kids or after kids, you know, with like yourself, empty nester. But, you know, that's I can guarantee a lot more people wanted to go but couldn't.
Yeah.
Well, so were you, so with your canoe, were you the only one in it, or were all four of you in it? How did that work with the vessels?
So there was two people in this canoe, and then the other canoes were, you know, partnered sometimes, and it was shifting different things as we went along. So sometimes solo paddling canoes, sometimes partnered up. But everybody took turns paddling the dugout canoe. So I was in the dugout canoe full time all the way to St. Louis, and then everybody else rotated through with Chris and I being the principal paddlers of that.
And then
I didn't want to break. No, I didn't want to be on the other canoes. And actually out in eastern Montana, Chris had picked up a stray dog on the reservation out there, and as a puppy, 2-month-old puppy. And so that Jubilee is what he named her. And so we then had a dog on the canoe. She grew up on the canoe, actually.
Oh my, are you kidding me? If I would have said that with the bow hunting sentence I put together, that would have just, there's a bestseller right there. That sounds like Huckleberry Finn or something, man. This is ridiculous. That's amazing. So you had a dog named Jubilee join you the whole time?
So it was about,
I'd say
6 weeks.
Okay.
Probably 6 weeks into the trip, she came on board and did all the rest. Yeah. I mean, she really grew up on the canoe.
How did she do? Did she ever jump out or fall out or any sort of challenges in that sense, raising a dog on the canoe trip?
The main thing was that, you know, she's an energetic puppy, and it was a little hard for her to get on the canoe in the morning, you know, to settle down. And, you know, she would whine, but after a while she'd settle down and, you know, short days were fine. But there were times when we needed to be just on the water all day, and that was really tough on her. But you know, the short days were okay because we'd get to camp, and she'd have plenty of time and freedom to run around, and that's what she really needed. So.
So you know, you've mentioned a few times of just different kinds of challenges. Do you feel there were any? By the way, I didn't mean to just rush through there. That is. First of all, crazy that the dog was on there. I had no idea None of my research, I saw a dog. So that just, I'm really delighted by that. That's a really cool aspect that I didn't know about. So that's so fast. I meant to ask, where's the dog now?
Oh, Jubilee and Chris belong together. She is such a sweetheart. It was really a thrill to have her along. Just made every day fun, you know, having that little puppy energy running around with the dog. Just a real sweetheart.
That is too cool, man. I love that. And now, you teach a class that's, teaching, because it's a school that teaches wilderness skills and self-sufficiency. Was there anything, did you notice anything in your skill set that was lacking on the experience where it's like, wow, I didn't expect I'd needed that as much as I do, or did you feel pretty well prepared?
I felt pretty well prepared, actually. I guess the main thing is that I'm just not real big on fishing pole fishing. And I didn't do that. The other guys were doing that. And if they were catching fish, then there was no need for me to. And if they were not catching fish, then I definitely didn't want to. So we had a degree of specialization like that. And Scott was also the GPS guy. So he brought the equipment for that. I could give him a list of coordinates, GPS coordinates for all the campsites, proposed campsites down the river. He could plug those in and, make sure that we could find those places and know how far we had to go. Or if we needed to input a new site, we could do that and navigate to that easily. So that was very helpful. And, I didn't have to do it. I didn't have to learn it. Was glad to find such a good partner that could handle that part.
So you seem pretty laid back about all this and pretty, didn't seem like there was a ton of surprise. Was there anything that was incredibly challenging about it for you or a part of it that was the most challenging or difficult?
Well, certainly the lakes. That's okay. The thing is I knew they would be challenging ahead of time. I had enough experience to know that. And that's the thing is that, I paddled the Missouri River, but I don't really think of myself as a paddler. I like canoeing. I canoed the Missouri River, which to me is different than paddling. And so I'm kind of a landlubber. And, there's a lot of guys that are just happy to get out there and just dig into the water and paddle. That's what a lot of people do is they just want to paddle to the end. And to me, I just wanted to paddle to get someplace interesting to get out and hike and explore. So I'm really not that fond of paddling, actually.
Okay. So how would you explain that difference? Is canoeing just kind of flowing with the river?
There's that flowing with the river. To me, I wanted to see everything along the way. I wanted to explore, check out every rock and tree and bush. And, so we're doing hiking and take layover days just to get out and see the area. We went to a lot of historical sites. So really being tourists as opposed to kind of the idea of getting out and conquering the river, that the goal is, to get to the end. That was always kind of secondary. The lakes were, the major concern even before we left. And I wanted to paddle some of that, but not all of that. And we did do Fort Peck. I mean, we paddled all the lakes down to Fort Peck, which was a – Fort Peck is, over 100 miles long. So just this immense lake out in eastern Montana. And it can be pretty challenging with the wind and the waves out there. But we did it. We pulled it off. We're very proud of that. And just didn't necessarily want to do it again. And when we got out to Lake Sakakawea in North Dakota, we paddled the first part into a marina there where we met a guy who he wanted to join us for to paddle part of the river. And when he was coming, he asked if there is anything we needed. And I said, well, do you happen to have an outboard motor laying around? And this was just another one of those mini serendipitous things, is he actually brought an outboard motor and we strapped it to the back of the dugout canoe, and we lashed the Scott's Old Town canoe to it, and then we were towing another canoe. And yeah, when we first put this together, by the time we got it done, it was getting into the afternoon, which is when the winds really pick up. But we were eager to get out there, and so we motored out onto the lake into this headwind. And then, of course, with the water coming in, you know, the waves coming in between the two canoes, it was sloshing up over the sides. And so we basically traveled traded paddling for sponging. So we were, you know, sponging and bailing continuously as we're jetting down the lake at 1.8 miles per hour.
Oh man, that poor motor.
And the you know, and there wasn't really anything to lash to on the dugout canoe, so all the lashings are super loose, and the you know, with the waves, the two canoes are kind of seesawing up and down at different rates, and the lashings are lurching back and forth, and the water's coming in, and it seemed like an eternity to get to the first bay that we could get out off the lake at. And that was only like 3 miles from where we started that day.
Oh my but gosh.
In principle, we proved that the motor could work. You know, it could only get better from there if we had better weather. So we used that across all the lakes in the Dakotas, which was Lake Sakakawea, Oahe, Lake Sharp and Lake Francis Case, which is between them, thinking in the range of 400 miles. And that took us 6 weeks with a motor. And a lot of that time was just spent waiting for the wind to stop blowing so that we could get out on the lake. We could move about 4.5 miles an hour under ideal conditions. And so, 6 weeks puttering along across all those lakes. And if we hadn't done that, I wouldn't be home yet.
Really? Wow. That's, did was anyone on the team, I mean, was there, how'd you guys do relationally? Was anyone frustrated with the pace at any time? Cause I've definitely done adventures kind of both ways, you know, for the enjoyment, kind of more traveling, going to see sights, and the others are, you know, going straight to the finish line. And I will say you have more fun when you're just kind of meandering, at least I do.
Yeah. For the most part, pretty good. The, John was more eager to get to the finish line, mostly because he had obligations at home, he needed to get back to. But most of the time it just made sense to, stick together. And then when we got, down near Omaha, Nebraska, that's when he really jetted ahead. We'd long ago sent the motor into storage, so we're just back to paddling. But we had a pretty fast current, and you know, if you just put enough hours, you could really get in the miles. So he went ahead of us at that point and reached St. Louis about 2 weeks before we got there.
Man, just the fact that you guys all were able to stick together that long and get that many people to take that much time off is pretty amazing. What an experience. You know, I found out about you through Daniel Hurd.
Oh yeah,
he said he joined you for part of it. He didn't tell me exactly what that was, so I actually don't know.
Yeah, okay. So Dan is bicycling the lower 48 states for suicide awareness. And so we had paddled into I think it was Decatur, Nebraska, and you know, all these little, there's so much flooding that like this park had been flooded I think 3 times that year or this year, and there was another big storm coming, and so the park manager, you know, suggested we come pitch our tents inside this sheltered area, and we did, and there was Dan was already camped there with, you know, with his bicycle and his tent there. And so we met and started hanging out together, and we were going more or less the same direction. So we started basically traveling together. He was going by bike and we were going by canoe, and we'd camp together at towns along the way. and then go touring some of the historical sites around. And so, yeah, that was a lot of fun. He's such a great guy, and it was fun connecting up in, you know, town after town.
That's so cool, man. Yeah, Dan was on the show earlier this year, and he's just been a pleasure. He reaches out pretty often with where he is and connecting us with, you know, with new potential guests, and he's just a great guy.
Oh, he's terrific. Yes,
that's awesome, and I love what he's doing. So once he comes through here, we're definitely gonna try to do something live. But yeah, he told me about this. I'm like, really? You ran into them and just joined them for a little bit? That is amazing. It's just, you just never know who's out there doing what. It's so amazing to me. Just incredible to me. And mm-hmm. when you put yourself out there, you never know who you're going to run into.
That's for sure.
it's an understatement for sure. So, you know, you get back home. You've only been home a couple weeks, man. What? Has it been hard to readjust to normal life back in Pony, Montana?
Well, you got to realize this is Pony, Montana. There's only 120 people here. So I live in a stone and log house I built myself. I cook on a wood stove. It's, you know, this has kind of been my life doing, you know, I write books on wilderness survival and botany and sustainable living and go camping a lot. This isn't that drastically different. You know, it's not like I'm going back to a cubicle. So
right.
The adjustment isn't that difficult for me. And I was writing the entire time. That's my primary occupation is, you know, I write books, and I was writing the entire time we were out. I wrote a blog that was picked up as a newspaper column by newspapers along the Missouri River. And so right now I'm working on turning that into a book. So I'm kind of still actually living the trip right now because I'm immersed in it every day.
Man, that's the way to do it. We do talk to a lot of people that their normal life is just so starkly different. And it's a whirlwind, you know, trying to readjust. I've definitely been there. And I've had other trips where I move into like a barn afterwards, and it just feels like the adventure just keeps on going. But, so for you, what an amazing ability to like come home, really process it, and really, you know, keep that thread of creativity and that thread of excitement going. Do you mind sharing where can people find out more about your books and about your story?
Sure. So you can go to elpel.info. So that's my last name, Tom Elpel, E-L-P as in Paul, E-L.info. And so there's information and videos about the, you know, making the canoe, links to the blog and everything. And there's links on that page to my books as well. And since this one is mostly written, it won't actually take that long to put it together. And I think by March it should be in print. It's five months on the Missouri River paddling a dugout canoe.
Oh my gosh. I am going to get a copy. I'm going to keep in touch because I want to be on the list, the pre-order list, because this sounds incredible. I've never done a trip this long on the water, but I'd love to. You know, that being said, what advice do you have for people who maybe have an idea and want to do something like this?
I think the main thing is to give it the time it needs and not to rush it. I just really not into that getting to the finish line thing. I think that just causes a lot of unnecessary stress and you know, repetitive stress injury and all that. You know, allow the time, whatever time the journey needs.
Now, is that also true for maybe preparing for, you know, an era in life where it's possible?
Well, totally. Actually, one of my books is called Green Prosperity, Quit Your Job, Live Your Dreams. And most people are actually within about 5 years of retiring if they just have a good plan to do that. And it's not so much about making more money, but as needing less. And the reason that I've been able to do the things that I like to do in my life is is because, you know, I've avoided having a lot of the expenses that other people do. Basically, I took the wilderness survival skills background that I had, you know, shelter, fire, water, food, and looked at those and said, you know, how can I make a lifestyle where I have no rent, no mortgage payment, you know, no energy bill, and, you know, pretty much no big monthly expenses. And so I ended up building this stone and log house on a limited budget there. And, you know, it's a solar and wood heated, and I have solar panels for electricity. And so, my expenses are pretty minimal. And because of that, I could afford to become a writer, that I could, you know, I could go into the writing without needing to produce an income from it, and write long enough until I did produce an income. And it's turned out really well. I actually launched my own publishing company, and, my bestseller, Botany in a Day, has sold over 100,000 copies. So,
congratulations.
So it's been, yeah, thank you. You know, not having monthly bills has been what's allowed me to become a writer, and it also allows me to say, you know, hey, I guess I'm going to take 5 months and go paddle the Missouri River.
Living the dream, man. I know that it's taken work, and I know that it's not easy at times, but what a rewarding way to live your life.
It's definitely been that.
Definitely been that. Type 2 fun at times, I'm sure. But
Yep. Boy,
what have you really getting a lot out of this little life we have? And can I ask you this lastly, I guess, I really appreciate your time, by the way. This has just been incredible. Anything on the horizon for you as far as adventures, or is it focusing on the book right now?
I've still got the bike trip and the hike on the Appalachian Trail in my mind. But I'm not in a particular hurry. I tend to kind of swing back and forth from doing the wilderness type experience to writing and publish other business things. It's, you know, I don't really have to do a lot of work to sustain myself. So it's more what kind of a positive contribution can I make in the world? So, you know, like my primitive skills camp, working with the public school kids, get them out of the classroom. So, you know, projects like that, and also a president of the Jefferson River chapter of the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation. So we've been raising funds to purchase campsites for the public on this water trail that we've created on the Jefferson River. And so, you know, just trying, I like to make a positive contribution to the world. I'm not really a personality that can handle playing all the time. I'll work my butt off for a few years, and then I'll decide, okay, now it's time to go play for a while.
There you go, play on, you know, 6 month grueling trip down the Missouri River.
Yes, a grueling trip down the Missouri River, sunning on log like turtles.
Oh man, this is one of the most fascinating adventures I've ever had the pleasure to talk about. So this is fantastic. Well, Thomas, man, I really appreciate you taking the time and being on the show. I hope I didn't use up too much of the precious daylight hours. You know, I'm sure you've got a lot you got to get done out there in Pony.
This was just fine, and really an honor to be on your show. So thank you for having me.
All right. Yes, sir. All right. Bye.
Bye now.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.